Michigan State University here in East Lansing is creating opportunities for students and faculty who are upset in the aftermath of the election to share their concerns and presumably get some peace of mind here. I'm reading this today here, courtesy of CBS Detroit via Twitter. For some students who are international students or who hold certain religious beliefs or marginalized identities, it's a pretty scary time, not just here at MSU, but across the United States. That comes from Antonio P., Assistant Director of Residence Education within MSU's East neighborhood. I see the University of Michigan Flint has created a similar opportunity for its students and faculty. According to the CBS report, today, the MSU Union will have healing spaces where students will have the opportunity to discuss how the campus community can come together after a long and divisive election season. Some MSU students say the university is perpetuating a coddling climate on campus. And this comes from Jeff Litton, president of the MSU College Republicans. Quote, if these events continue, it'll overall hurt students when they go into the real world where these kinds of safe spaces don't exist. There you go. That is all courtesy of CBS Detroit. The world is watching as Donald Trump prepares to become the 45th president. Many are waiting to see what policies will emerge under Trump's leadership. Environmental regulation is one of them. A year ago, the U.S. joined more than 100 nations signing the Paris Agreement, which sets forth actions to slow the effects of climate change. Now, some analysts believe a Trump administration may be poised to withdraw U.S. participation that could significantly roll back greenhouse gas emission standards. My first guest today is chair of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism here at Michigan State. Eric Friedman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who formerly wrote for the Detroit News, and he's just returned from an environmental journalism workshop in Kenya, an area of the world that's keenly watching America's next moves. Eric, welcome back to Current State.
It's good to be on the show again.
How did you find yourself spending a week in Nairobi, Kenya?
I was invited by the Graduate School of Media and Communications at the Aga Khan University in Nairobi to put on a week-long workshop for professional journalists from East African countries.
You were in Kenya on election day. Did you have a chance to see how the election was reported in the Kenyan media?
In the run-up, there was a lot of coverage, including the endorsement of Hillary Clinton by the president of Kenya right before the election, obviously not casting any votes there. But it is the home country of Barack Obama's father and his half-brother. So there's that interest. And in fact, when I was in the city, somebody proudly pointed out the hotel where President Obama had stayed when he visited Kenya. But the journalists follow our election primarily on the international media. So they'll look at BBC, they'll look at CNN. So they know how we're covering the election. Their perspective is different because their interests are different.
Mm-hmm. What discussions, if any, did the election spark between you and your hosts or other journalists there?
The biggest topic after the results came in, what impact will this have on U.S.-African relations? You mentioned environmental because climate change is a major concern in East Africa. Temperatures are rising. It affects the crops. It affects the invasive species. It affects air quality, which is a significant urban problem. Also concerns with trade and economic development and the kind of foreign assistance that the United States has given to Africa and elsewhere in the developing world.
What about immigration?
It's a concern in Kenya because of the proximity and the border with South Sudan. But East Africa, we have conflicts in Somalia, refugees from there, in Sudan and South Sudan, refugees from there, elsewhere in Africa, North Africa, refugees going to Europe, Ethiopia and Eritrea, two repressive regimes, a lot of political refugees, Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, civil war, militants, lot of concern there, leading to more refugees, more refugee camps, and then where do these people go? They can't go home.
Donald Trump has spent a lot of time talking about how he'd like to rework or throw out a lot of trade agreements, and NAFTA and TPP tend to suck a lot of the air out of the room there, but there is a trade agreement that involves African countries. The African Growth and Opportunity Act was passed back in 2008. It was extended last year until 2025. Is this on the radar of the folks in
Nobody talked
Kenya,
with or? Me specifically about that trade agreement. They were concerned more broadly with U.S. support for economic development, which includes trade, but it also includes health services. HIV, AIDS is a problem in some of the countries there. Malaria, Ebola, those kinds of things which have medical implications, but insufficient health services by the governments. And Western aid from the U.S. and Europe is essential.
Did terror or security come up at all while you were there?
Not in the context of the election, but you can see in the capital, Nairobi, a lot of security guards in front of buildings. There are metal detectors at the shopping malls. This follows a bombing attack at an upscale shopping mall a couple of years ago.
And this is very interesting, though, too. You spoke about how you said the president of Kenya voiced support for Hillary Clinton, but Malik Obama, the president's half-brother, is a Trump supporter.
Right.
How interesting. Did you hear about or encounter much support for Donald Trump?
Nobody I spoke to, but of course I was dealing primarily with journalists,
right,
and perhaps a little more sophisticated, and with people at the university in the administration.
We do want to get to a little bit more in-depth question and content here involving the environment, which was really the reason for your trip. We'll remind our listeners, we're talking about the impact of the presidential election abroad, specifically in East Africa. Our guest has just returned from a week-long journalism workshop in Nairobi, Kenya. Eric Friedman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and chair of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism here at Michigan State. NPR aired an interview yesterday with Ophabia Quist-Arkton, the network's Africa correspondent, who noted that a number of African leaders have congratulated President-elect Trump, and some number of them are considered dictators with less than stellar human rights records. Does it seem to you that those leaders might be expecting the U.S. to ease off on some of the human rights accusations that they've been hearing for a number of years?
They're concerned with international courts, human rights claims, war crimes claims. And if the United States is not vigilant and aggressive in pushing for human rights, they'll be able to continue their repressive, often multi-decade-long regimes. In the countries I was at, I looked at the press systems there, and in East Africa, Rwanda, Somalia, Burundi, and Ethiopia all have not free press systems. Kenya, Tanzania, Botswana, Uganda have partly free press systems. And the indication of how free or repressive a press system is reflects the political freedom and transparency of the government, whether it's in Africa, U.S., Latin America, Asia.
Climate change, as I think you've pointed out, is a real concern in many parts of the developing world, particularly in the Indian Ocean region. Tell us a little bit more about the discussion and the topics involving climate change that
sure,
you heard or you participated in.
A couple of them. I had Professor Jenny Olson from our College of Communication Arts and Sciences Skype in, and she talked about research she and her colleagues are doing in East Africa on maize. Maize is the essential crop. Climate change is affecting how well it grows or how it doesn't grow, the search for new weather-resistant species, and that's one thing that's close to the heart of Africans. Second, water is warming. It's contributing to problems in Lake Victoria, which is the largest Great Lake in Africa. So it promotes invasive species. It increases the negative impacts of industrial pollution and pesticides that wash into the lake. Air quality, major problem in the cities, particularly in the low-income areas. Climate change, warming temperatures make that more of a health problem. 500,000 Africans die each year as a result of air pollution, according to the World Health Organization.
You mentioned Lake Victoria, and you alluded to Africa's great lakes. The others, I guess, are considered Lake Tanganyika and Lake Malawi. Does Africa contend with the same kinds of water management issues as North America? You said invasive species.
Yes, invasive species. Microplastics are now showing up as they are in our Great Lakes.
Yeah.
Industrial runoff and agricultural runoff. Overfishing. The problem of development. There's sand mining near some of the tributaries that go into the lakes, and that's of concern because it damages the spawning beds for fish. Fish populations are smaller. They're overfishing. Just as example, in the 1970s, there were 12,000 boats fishing on Lake Victoria. Now, 60,000 boats fishing, another 2,000 added each year. Mm. So the smaller fish are getting caught. They're using illegal small mesh on some of the nets. And the huge demand for food in a growing population area is being adversely affected.
How do educated Africans feel here? Do they tend to feel there's not enough action on the environment, or are they between a rock and a hard place, or what?
And there's the balance between environmental protection and the need for economic development, for jobs. There's a migration from rural communities and villages into the cities. I was talking to a driver the other day. Where do these people work? Well, some of them have tiny little kiosks, or they sell things on the street. There's no industrial structure, no manufacturing structure that can accommodate a large inflow of immigrants internally within the country from poor rural areas and farms into the cities.
Eric Friedman is the chair of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism here at Michigan State University. We're talking about his recent return here from Nairobi, Kenya, where he participated in a week-long journalism workshop. What he heard there, what he did there. A year ago, nearly 200 nations, including the United States, signed the Paris Agreement, which is viewed as the world's first comprehensive climate agreement. Its main purpose is to, I'll quote here, this is a little hard to follow, but I think we can all stay ahead of this here. Its main purpose is to hold the global average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Donald Trump has indicated his administration may pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement. Was that discussed while you were there?
We didn't talk about specific agreements, but there'd been climate change conferences in Africa as well. The week before I was there, there was a conference in Tanzania on climate change with both African and non-African scientists. And they're concerned about the impact of policy. Is it reflecting what science is telling us about the risk of rising temperatures? Regardless of whether there's a treaty or not, the problem exists.
Mm-hmm.
The scientists realize that.
Have you thought about how the developing world would be affected if the United States pulls out of the Paris Agreement?
My concern is that they will see that if the industrial countries, particularly the United States, are not taking positive steps to reduce emissions, why should they? We've been developed. Our industries have thrived. Why don't they have a turn?
Mm. Eric Friedman is our guest here on Current State, just back from a trip to Nairobi, Kenya. What's the most difficult thing about covering environmental issues around the world?
There's two. One is access to information in places, particularly in countries that are not free. And the second is that news media in the developing world usually doesn't have a lot of financial resources to travel, to put together investigative teams. One of the things we talked about was the desire for collaboration among journalists from more than one country to make it possible to cover issues like wildlife poaching, trafficking in ivory and rhino horns. They're cross borders. Air pollution doesn't pay any attention to political borders. So journalists in a region should have a way to collaborate and be encouraged to work together, not just on investigative pieces like the Panama Papers, but in general on ongoing coverage of environmental issues.
We got less than a minute, Eric. In this country and in the West in general, I would say, there is a school of thought that's critical of what it claims is overregulation because there's simply too much of it. And as you alluded to earlier, it hampers important economic growth. I imagine some number of people in Africa feel the same. Did you encounter any of that?
Not that regulation itself is bad or inhibits growth, but that the governments that impose the regulations often don't take into consideration the broader interests. They're more interested in keeping power and the power and influence of the major industries, mining, logging in particular.
We've been talking about elections and the environment here on Current State, particularly the perspective outside the United States. Eric Friedman's recently returned from a week-long environmental journalism workshop he helped lead at Aga Khan University in Nairobi, Kenya. Eric is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and chair of the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism here at Michigan State. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Coming up on Current State, more talk about the environment, this time a little closer to home. Michigan environmental officials designated the state's tiny piece of Lake Erie an impaired waterway last week because of the lake's recent history of destructive algae blooms. We'll learn more from an environmentalist who applauds that designation, Mike Schreiberg, Great Lakes Regional Executive Director of the National Wildlife Federation, coming up on Current State. Well, it isn't unusual for artists to use their works for charity events. In recent years, in and around Lansing, there have been public displays, including imaginatively decorated cows or elaborately redesigned pianos. The Capital Region Habitat for Humanity is using works of art this week to raise awareness and some money at an event they're calling the Door Jam. It's Thursday night at the Waldemar Nature Center in Lansing. Habitat has a young professionals division working on the Door Jam. Member Ben Rathbun is here to tell us more about the event and what they hope to accomplish. Welcome, Ben.
Good morning.
And also here today, artist Jack Bergeron. Good to have you with us, Jack.
Thank you.
So were the pianos and the cows we've seen around Lansing recently, were they influential in launching the Door Jam?
We love seeing public art here in Lansing, and actually one of the artists who did keys for the City of the Pianos has really been involved this year with our Door Jam event. Mm. He's actually allowed us to put some of the doors up in his art gallery in the Lansing Mall, and they're also up in the center section of the mall where Santa is from now until tomorrow. We're going to move them actually to Waldemar.
Has the door theme been tried elsewhere that you're aware of?
There's a few Habitat groups throughout the nation who have done a similar event, but we're kind of taking a different spin this year and doing a live auction with doors as well as a silent auction with some cabinet doors and smaller items.
Jack Bergeron, what kind of guidance, if any, were you given when it came to creating your door?
This is the second year that I've done this. Last year they had a theme that they wanted the artists to work around the concept of community. And this year it was Welcome Home. So other than that, you were able to pick up a door from the Habitat store, and no holds barred. They just said, go at it.
Oh. Tell us about the door you've decorated for Door Jam. It's called A Light in the Window.
Right. I'm a metal sculptor, and so I wanted to incorporate materials that I'm used to using. So I use metal and paint. And who knows where inspiration comes from. You sit around, you think about something for a long time, and then an idea pops in your head. I came up with the idea of a pathway using kind of abstract imagery toward a house with a light in the window. And
okay.
That, to me, a welcoming light in the window felt like welcome home.
it seems as though artists are often asked to do this sort of thing, work for free for a charity event. Do you get this a lot? Do you participate in these kinds of things?
When I'm made aware of it, fortunately, last year, a friend of mine on Facebook posted the event. It sounded interesting, and I clicked on the link and got involved. But I'm sure many artists would also do that if they knew what was available.
Jack, how many, Ben, how many doors have been created for this?
This year we have close to 30 items between the live auction and the silent auction.
Okay. Again, we're talking with Ben Rathbun of the Capital Region Habitat Young Professionals Organization about the Door Jam this week. Artists like our other guest, Jack Bergeron, have decorated doors from the Habitat Restore, and these works of art will be sold on Thursday night. Ben, tell us about the Young Professionals group you're working with here at Habitat. What is your group trying to accomplish?
Well, you know, our group started back about 6 months ago, where we realized that MSU had a Habitat chapter, and then we were losing a lot of our volunteers until they were kind of the retired age that you typically think of as people who are out on Habitat site builds. So what we're really looking to do is involve young professionals between the ages of 21 and 40 to try and get them involved in the Habitat mission. So we're working to connect young professionals, but while we're building our network, we're also working for a cause to continue Habitat's mission.
Are they out there building houses as well?
We have done some projects as well. Actually, back in July, the Habitat Young Professionals had a team out every day for Habitat's Rock the Block, which is a neighborhood revitalization project where we worked in Old Town and did several home building projects. Mm.
Jack, tell us about your work outside of events like the Door Jam. Is you work? You talked about your you work with metal,
right?
A lot.
Yeah, I've been an artist in Lansing for 45 years. Mm. I've got some public sculpture in Lansing that I did in the 70s.
You're primarily a sculptor? You consider yourself a sculptor then?
Yeah, although I was a television courtroom artist for 7 years, so I've got kind of a drawing and a sculpture background and interest.
Do you make a living at this, or is this kind of a retirement gig?
This is a retirement gig here. Whatever comes up. Every couple of years or so, a friend and I show in one of the local galleries, gives us a reason to keep making stuff.
And you're on the faculty at LCC?
I was.
You were. Okay.
I retired 3 years ago from LCC.
Could these doors be used as real doors somewhere, or are these just displayed as works of art?
I guess ironic you bring that up. The front door on my dad's apartment is actually Jack's door that he built last year for the inaugural Door Jam, which last year was called Doors for Humanity. Typically, the doors this year are more considered art, something you would hang on your wall as opposed to a functional door, but certainly the door could be a functional door if you wanted it to be.
Since you're heading up the Young Professionals division here at Habitat, are you connecting more with younger artists, Ben?
For this event, you know, we've really worked with quite a few people, from Jack to we have quite a few doors that were actually made by LCC students, a few doors that were made by students at Holt High School. And then we've also worked with younger people in the community. We actually worked over at the Boys and Girls Club to create what we call the Shoebox Project. So all of the children at the Boys and Girls Club actually took a shoebox and transformed it using household items into their dream room. So we're using these shoeboxes as decorations at the event. So we've really looked to get people involved from the elementary level to the college level, all the way up to people like Jack.
Jack, are you just always focused on one project at a time, or do you bounce around? Do you have three or four things going at the same time?
I have a pole barn studio, so I have things kind of in the works. I mean, sometimes you get an idea, and then you sort of let it sit there for a while, and then something else comes up. So as long as you've got enough space, you can always try something else.
I would imagine it would be fun to watch the sparks, kind of the intellectual sparks fly. If you've got a couple things going on at the same time,
it's fun.
You never know how they connect with each other. In your brain, you never know how they connect.
That's correct.
Give us some more details about Thursday's event at Waldemar here. You'll have live music from a band that was in our studio playing not too long ago, the Pat Zelenka Project. Ben, just describe what's happening here.
So the event is from 6 to 9 at Woldemere Nature Center. So it's $10 to get in, which gets you entrance in, gets you 3 drink tickets and food, which is sponsored by Applebee's. We also then will be giving a raffle ticket and an outlet cover. All the outlet covers were painted by local elementary students. You can then purchase additional raffle tickets, and we are going to be raffling off a few of the cabinet doors as well.
We want to thank both of our guests. We've been talking about Thursday night's event, the Door Jam. The Capital Region Habitat Young Professionals Organization is the driving force behind this. You can see and bid on Habitat Restore doors that have been decorated by local artists. That's at Woldemere Nature Center in Lansing, 6 to 9 p.m. on Thursday. We've been talking with organizer Ben Rathbun and artist Jack Bergeron. Thanks for joining us in Current State.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, we'll get a preview of the MSU College of Music's production of the Kemetic opera, The Elixir of Love. Current State's Jamie Paisley attends one of the rehearsals to get a closer look. That's coming up on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Glad you're along here today. You can catch everything we create on the Current State podcast at Stitcher and iTunes, and everything also goes to WKAR.org. Every Tuesday, Current State focuses on the environment in Michigan or the Great Lakes. Last week, state environmental officials designated Michigan's tiny piece of Lake Erie an impaired waterway. That's because algae blooms have become more common there and threaten fish and other wildlife. The algae blooms are mainly the result of fertilizer runoff into the lake from farms. You'll remember that in the summer of 2014, 400,000 people in the Toledo area were briefly unable to drink city water because algae had created unsafe levels of a particular toxin. Now, this impaired designation is important because it can lead to stronger federal action. To learn more about the designation from an environmental angle, we welcome Michael Schreiberg, Great Lakes Regional Executive Director at the National Wildlife Federation. He's based in Ann Arbor. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
How did you respond when you heard Governor Snyder making this designation?
Well, very positively. This is pollution that not only shut down the city of Toledo's water system, but this is pollution you can literally see from space. It's very clear under the Clean Water Act that this protection is needed and legally required, but it actually takes political will to make it happen. And so we view this very favorably, although it is clearly the beginning of a long process. It's not the end of a process.
Were you expecting it? Were you anticipating this?
Well, yes and no. Yes, because it's clear that this is a mandate under the Clean Water Act. But no, because oftentimes good policy doesn't overtake the politics. In this case, that happened, but you can never guarantee those sorts of outcomes in Lansing, to be honest with you.
Such a designation could lead to federal action, more stringent pollution controls. What kind of controls? What can you tell us about what could stem from this?
Well, the biggest thing that it does is it creates a pollution diet for the Great Lakes, for Lake Erie specifically. And that means you look at all the sources of pollution that are coming in that are causing these massive algal blooms, which vary a bit by year, but we saw a huge one last year and in other years. And you see what the sources are, and then you distribute the amount of reductions needed in pollution amongst those sources. It's pretty hard to make progress until you know exactly where the pollution is coming from and exactly what you need to get there. It then has tools under the Clean Water Act to actually manage that pollution and reduce it to the level where the lake is hopefully no longer impaired, meaning you can use it for drinking water, meaning it's not harming aquatic life and fish.
We most often hear of fertilizer fertilizer runoff from farms as being the main culprit. Is that it, or are there other contributing factors?
Well, that is the dominant contribution. It's certainly agriculture. It's fertilizer and it's manure. I mean, what happens is it's put on the fields, and particularly when you have big storms, it washes away into rivers and streams, and it winds up in the lakes. It feeds these algae blooms, and then you wind up with what we've seen in Lake Erie. There are other sources, wastewater treatment plants, urban runoff, et cetera. Now, those sources are small in comparison, but they're not insignificant. Something like, the estimates vary, but something like 70 to 80% of the pollution comes from agriculture.
So it appears the ball is now in the EPA's court. Do you have any thoughts on how they might respond?
Yeah, I mean, I think the EPA is going to respond positively to Michigan's designation because it is so clear under the Clean Water Act that Lake Erie is impaired. If Lake Erie isn't impaired, and that's the technical term for it, it's hard to see what body of water would be. I mean, this is not subtle here. We've probably all seen the images of the deep green water in the lakes from years past. So this is right under the definition of it, and I'd be surprised if the U.S. EPA does not act favorably towards what Michigan is proposing.
And when do you expect a response?
Well, they have 30 days under statute to do that, although they have regularly ignored that deadline in the past. But 30 days, and the clock just started on that on Thursday.
And I understand that Ohio has determined its part of Lake Erie is not impaired. How does that impact Michigan's opposite conclusion?
Yeah, this is where it starts to get very interesting. Ohio has actually said that they're part of the open waters of Lake Erie, and that's most of Lake Erie, I should add. Michigan has a very small percentage of Lake Erie itself, just the very, very northern
part. Like 2%, right?
About 2%, that's right, of the open water. Is not impaired. Ohio is defying logic on that. It's hard to see under the same criteria in the Clean Water Act how Ohio can come to the conclusion that Lake Erie is just fine, whereas Michigan says it's impaired. I think that the U.S. EPA is going to side with Michigan, as it should, and actually has the authority over Ohio to declare it impaired in Ohio as well. I mean, it's one body of water. It defies logic to say the pollution doesn't stop at the border of Ohio and Michigan. And I think that the EPA will do the right thing on this.
There are already agreements in play involving these algae blooms. There's one involving states, Michigan and Ohio. There's something else with Canada. Does Michigan's designation impact existing agreements or existing algae abatement efforts that are already in play?
Yeah, what it does is support it. What's happened, we have what I would consider a handshake agreement between the governors of Michigan and Ohio, as well as the premier of Ontario, to cut pollution by 40%. We also have the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, which is joint between the U.S. and Canada, that also gets to that same amount. But what we have now, this impairment actually falls under the Clean Water Act. That is a strong tool that gives you legal backing, and it actually gives you something that will last beyond what are essentially voluntary and handshake agreements. So these tools are all very complementary towards each other, and they build on each other. And I think that's the important lesson to take away from this. But the Clean Water Act is the tool that, you know, has been in place since 1970 to actually help clean up waterways. So it's critical that it's used to the maximum effect for Lake Erie.
One Michigan farm group said the designation was unnecessary and wouldn't solve the algae problem. Jim Byram of the Michigan Agribusiness Association said, and I'll quote here, "Instead of encouraging constructive solutions, today's announcement sets the table for even more government mandates, largely driven by fringe groups out to dismantle Michigan agriculture." Any validity to those points?
Well, there's so much wrong with the statement. It's hard to know where to start. It seems like he's considering the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality a fringe group in some way. But ultimately, this is about agriculture stepping up to the responsibility not to poison our drinking water and pollute our lakes. It is the waste from that industry that is actually causing this problem. No other industry gets away with their waste actually contaminating other uses without actually taking some responsibility. So it's a little surprising that somebody who I think knows better than that, someone from the Agribusiness Association, would try and really absolve themselves of the responsibility. Agriculture is the dominant source of the pollution, and they'll have to be a dominant part of the solution for this, as well as other contributing factors. But it seems to me like this is kind of a a statement without merit, and I'm not sure exactly where it stems from.
This is Current State's weekly environmental segment. Our guest today, Mike Schreiber, Great Lakes Regional Executive Director of the National Wildlife Federation based in Ann Arbor. While we've got you on the program here, Mike, there's intense speculation about a Trump administration's impact on all kinds of policy, but the Great Lakes are one of those things. There are different comments, different signals to digest here. What do you think?
Well, it's really hard to know, and I don't want to totally punt on that question, but it's early to know. We have some really bad signals. I mean, we have a transition team for the EPA that's headed up by a climate denier who really seems to have no basis in science in what he's talking about. We also have a candidate in Donald Trump who has said that he would like to eliminate the EPA, for example. On the flip side, on the Great Lakes, we have Donald Trump campaign on record as saying they support the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, one of the core programs to clean up the lakes, and they have big investments in infrastructure. So you tell me, you've got a candidate that says they want to eliminate the agency, but they support a program to clean up the Great Lakes. Mm. Pretty hard to know how to interpret that.
Yeah. You are Current State's first guest who serves on the state's Pipeline Safety Advisory Board. I feel obligated to ask you about this. You and the other members were appointed by Governor Snyder, and one of your main responsibilities is to organize a risk analysis study of Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline running near the Mackinac Straits. Talk to us about the process so far. How far along is it?
Well, we're in the initial stages. There are consultants that are working on talking about or analyzing what exactly is at risk from Line 5. So over 700 miles of shoreline and 17,000 square miles of open water are potentially at risk for an oil spill. We have some of the best experts in the world that are looking at what that would mean in putting a dollar amount on it, drinking water, recreational tourism, all the other pieces on that. In parallel, there's a group that's actually looking at the alternatives to Line 5. So if Line 5 were to not carry oil anymore and were to be shut down, how would oil transport in the region look? What are the alternatives and what are the costs and benefits? Those are two studies that are underway right now. From my perspective, I wish they were going a little bit more quickly, but this is really important work that ultimately I believe is going to lead to decommissioning Line 5. That's the stated goal of the Attorney General, and this is part of that process. Mm.
What is the timeline like here? When do you expect to have your risk analysis finished?
It'll be finished next fall, so we're a little under a year out from that, and that's why I'm saying I wish it was a faster process, but it takes some time to do this analysis, and it's about September is when it'll be done.
The Wildlife Service supported the University of Michigan study from earlier this year that looked into the potential impact of a Line 5 spill. You quoted the 700 miles of Great Lakes shoreline potentially vulnerable to a spill. I think that study is where that number came from, if I understand this all correctly. More broadly, Mike, what do you think of the U of M study?
Well, I think this was a great piece of work, and that was what I was referring to before. We had the best scientists in the world and the experts on the Mackinac Straits look at what happens if oil spills, because this is a really complex ecosystem here. You actually have water that can flow 10 times the volume of Niagara Falls, but it doesn't flow in one direction. One day it could be flowing towards Lake Huron, the other day towards Lake Michigan, and you can have different flow at the bottom, middle, and top. You mix that in with winter conditions and the high waves and all those things, and you have a very, very complex environment. So we worked with the University of Michigan to get the best expertise that there is out there to look at various spill scenarios and see what would happen. That's actually forming the baseline for all of the state's work. And when you have an institution like the University of Michigan around, you want to use that expertise to inform your policy decisions. So, and that's what we help facilitate.
So their study is playing a key role in what in your study that you will be creating.
That's right. Their study is forming the baseline of the study that the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board is overseeing. So the University of Michigan basically gave, if you think of it, they put out a map that said, here's the likelihood in different areas that a spill could impact them. What's happening now, the risk analysis is filling in those areas and saying, what exactly is at risk? What are the assets there for the state? What is the value of those things? So the University of Michigan set the baseline. The consultants working on this right now are going at least a level or two deeper.
Mike Schreiberg is the Great Lakes Regional Executive Director of the National Wildlife Federation. We've been talking about last week's action by Michigan officials designating its portion of Lake Erie an impaired waterway because of harmful algae blooms. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Current State discusses Michigan's environment every Tuesday. Our segments and others about the Great Lakes environment can be found at WKAR.org and at GreatLakesEcho.org. This week, the MSU Opera Theater brings another production to the Fairchild Theater. Current State's Jamie Paisley joins me now after attending one of the final. You get to attend so many rehearsals. That sounds like so much fun.
It can be, but I mean, it's at the end of a workday, so yeah. There's always that element to
That's
it.
That's right.
And this opera, it's called L'Elixir d'Amore, or The Elixir of Love. It's a bel canto comedy opera by the Italian composer Gaetano Donizetti. So what is that term? I just kind of threw that out there, bel canto. For that, I spoke with the director of The Elixir, the MSU College of Music voice faculty member Melanie Helton, who gives her definition of bel canto.
Well, it means beautiful singing, and it really is a singer-driven art form, a period of time. It's long lines, long melodies, beautiful accompaniments, but not a lot of like fancy orchestra stuff. Much more accompanimental and just a melody.
Now, you and I spoke before your recital that you had earlier this year, and you talked about the cast of Elixir of Love. They were already assembled. How does that process work? When do you cast the fall, winter opera?
Well, what happens is in the spring, we have juries, which are like the final exams for our voice students. And then a day later, we'll do opera auditions for the fall. So they have the summer to learn their music. And then they come back in the fall, hopefully ready to go and pretty much memorized.
This is a show, Elixir of Love, similar to Cats, in which you got memory as the number. What is the famous bit of music that's in Elixir of Love?
Una furtiva lagrima, which has been made famous by every tenor since Caruso to Pavarotti.
Was that kind of the focus point of how you cast this opera?
Well, that was the audition piece for them. They had to sing that for the audition, but it really isn't. It's just a lovely little moment amongst many lovely moments. It just happens to have been the piece that everybody latches onto. It's at the very end of the opera. Poor Nemorino, who's been kind of a nerd the whole time, has finally figured out that Adina loves him, and he is just thrilled about it.
My name is Isaac Frischman. I am in my last year of my doctoral program here at Michigan State. I have luckily been able to participate in L'Elixir d'Amore this semester. My character in the show is Nemorino, the main character of the opera, the, as I quote, sad sack of the opera. Everyone pities him because he's just the Eeyore of the bunch, if you will. So that's my character, yeah. Usually what happens is then you have the whole summer, if you're cast in the spring for the fall show, you have the whole summer to prepare the role, and then rehearsals start basically the week before classes begin. Actually, surprisingly enough, this show was actually, you had to present Una Furtiva Lagrima no matter what. All the tenors had to sing it no matter what because they wanted to see it. It's a very difficult aria to sing, and because of that, they want you to prepare it and present yourself as best as you humanly can. So, yeah, it was, for me, they had asked me to prepare the aria, and they asked me to do the role, and I'm very blessed to do so.
Have you done it before?
No, this is my actual first time doing this role in particular. I've done a few other roles multiple times, but this is the first time I've done Elixir of Love.
Also bel canto, I assume?
Yes. Yeah, I did Mozart's Così Van Tutte, would have been my fifth and sixth time. And then I'm actually doing La Cenerentola, or Cinderella, by Rossini in the spring, in January actually. I wouldn't really consider it spring, in St. Louis.
Did Did you actually do your undergraduate as well? Or?
Yeah, I did my undergraduate. My undergraduate was actually in University of Nebraska at Omaha. And then I started my master's program here at MSU in 2012. And then after I graduated, I was presented the opportunity to continue on with my doctoral work until I aged a little more, because in the opera world, you have to be a little older to actually be taken seriously. Rather than just like go out there and just hope for the best, I decided to buckle down and get some more schoolwork, prepare some more, learn how to use my voice a little bit better, and here I am.
Because the touring musician, that's probably where you're aiming to go in a doctoral world. Is the Met auditions something that you're aiming towards?
I actually have the Met comp auditions. My district is December 3rd. And then I was supposed to do it here in Detroit on October 29th, but due to schedule conflicts in the regionals in the spring because of the gig I have at St. Louis, can't ask one gig to release me for another, so.
We just spoke with Isaac Frischman, one of the two MSU students portraying Nemorino in Donizetti's The Elixir of Love, coming to the Fairchild Theater this week as directed by Melanie Helton. And Melanie, when it comes to the title of this comic opera, what is this famed Elixir of Love?
It pertains to basically a little bit of snake oil that Dulcamara is selling. He is a traveling salesman who claims to be a famous doctor who has an elixir that will cure everything. And so Nemorino buys a bottle of this. It happens to be Bordeaux, and is probably 80 proof.
Spoiler alert.
A little Dutch courage.
The voices that you have are all students, which is to say they are pre-prime. What sort of challenges does that bring out in getting everybody together? Because there are different singing abilities, and the blend can be a little bit tricky sometimes.
First of all, it's language, and we are in Italian language, and we have an Italian conductor, which is wonderful, because he can give us all sorts of insights into how we inflect the language. Our students learn many languages by what they call IPA, International Phonetic Alphabet, but it can't teach you the stresses and the sort of idioms and the way you double certain things and you don't double other things. And so in terms of the voices, these are all, I'm trying to think, these are mostly graduate students and seniors, which is unusual. Normally we would have a couple of undergraduates, but because the principal roles in this, I mean, there really aren't any small parts. They're all leading roles. And so normally those would go to our more senior singers. We have everyone, though, from senior music education majors to Isaac Frischman, who's a doctoral student, who I believe you spoke to. And Isaac is actually having a professional debut this winter with the Opera Theater of St. Louis in Cinderella.
There are two casts for Elixir of Love. Why is that done?
Well, first of all, it's to give more students opportunities. That's part of our mission here. Second of all, people do get sick. And that way we have a built-in what we call a cover. In the theater, they'd call it an understudy. We call it a cover.
Particularly as the seasons are changing.
Indeed, indeed. I think we've missed the first bout of flu, so I'm hoping we sandwich in the second.
Currently, we're in the Hart Recital Hall that's in the College of Music building, but it's going to be transferring to the Fairchild Theater. And when does the show actually last?
We have next Wednesday, the 17th, 18th, and 19th. We are skipping Saturday because Ohio State takes precedent, and we don't think that there'd be too many opera goers able to get onto campus and having a Sunday, so that's unusual. Normally, we would have a Saturday night, but it was determined to be the better part of valor to not fight that battle.
You can find tickets and more information about the MSU Opera Theater's production of Donizetti's The Elixir of Love online at music.msu.edu. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, singer Art Garfunkel performs in Jackson this weekend ahead of his concert at Jackson Community College. Current State Scott Pohl talks with him about his musical journey and what he's been up to lately. Art Garfunkel tomorrow on Current State. We'll also talk with an MSU grad who's been cast in Hamilton in Chicago. Jonathan Kirkland plays George Washington in the hit musical and tells us what the role means to him and about the whole experience. That's tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. The Current State Podcast, your informative, insightful, indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget us. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. On Facebook, we're at Current State from WKAR. So glad you could join us today. I'm Mark Bayshore. See you tomorrow on Current State on WKAR.